Chapter 34. Vampa.
The time of the carnival was at hand. The Comte de Saint-Felice announced a grand masked ball to which all that were distinguished in Rome were invited. Teresa had a great desire to see this ball. Luigi asked permission of his protector, the steward, that she and he might be present amongst the servants of the house. This was granted. The ball was given by the Count for the particular pleasure of his daughter Carmela, whom he adored. Carmela was precisely the age and figure of Teresa, and Teresa was as handsome as Carmela. On the evening of the ball, Teresa was attired in her best, her most brilliant hair ornaments and gayest glass beads. She was in the costume of the women of Frescati. Luigi wore the very picturesque garb of the Roman peasant at holiday time. They both mixed, as they had leave to do, with the servants and peasants. The fete was magnificent. Not only was the villa brilliantly illuminated, but thousands of coloured lanterns were suspended from the trees in the garden, and very soon the palace overflowed to the terraces and the terraces to the garden walks. At each cross-path was an orchestra, and tables spread with refreshments. The guests stopped, formed quadrilles, and danced in every part of the grounds they pleased. Carmela was attired like a woman of Sonnino. Her cap was embroidered with pearls, the pins in her hair were of gold and diamonds, her girdle was of Turkey silk, with large embroidered flowers, her bodice and skirt were of cashmere, her apron of Indian muslin, and the buttons of her corset were of jewels. Two of her companions were dressed, the one as a woman of Nettuno, and the other as a woman of Laricia. Four young men of the richest and noblest families of Rome accompanied them with that Italian freedom which has not its parallel in any other country of the world. They were attired as peasants of Albano, Velletri, Civita Castellana, and Sora. We need hardly add that these peasant costumes, like those of the females, were brilliant with gold and jewels. Carmela wished to make a uniform quadrille, but there was one lady wanting. Carmela looked all round her, but not one of the guests had a costume similar to her own, or those of her companions. The Comte de Saint-Felice pointed out to her, in the group of peasants, Teresa, who was hanging on Luigi's arm. "Will you allow me, father?" said Carmela. "Certainly," replied the Count. "Are we not in carnival time?" Carmela turned towards the young man who was talking with her, and saying a few words to him, pointed with her finger to Teresa. The young man followed with his eyes the lovely hand which made this indication, bowed in obedience, and then went to Teresa and invited her to dance in a quadrille, directed by the Count's daughter. Teresa felt something like a flame pass over her face. She looked at Luigi, who could not refuse his assent. Luigi slowly relinquished Teresa's arm, which he had held beneath his own, and Teresa, accompanied by her elegant cavalier, took her appointed place with much agitation in the aristocratic quadrille. Certainly, in the eyes of an artist, the exact and strict costume of Teresa had a very different character from that of Carmela and her companions. And Teresa was frivolous and coquettish, and thus the embroidery and muslins, the cashmere waist-girdles, all dazzled her, and the reflection of sapphires and diamonds almost turned her giddy brain. Luigi felt a sensation hitherto unknown arising in his heart. It was like an acute pain which gnawed at his heart and then passed thrillingly throughout his frame, chasing through his veins and pervading his entire body. He followed with his eye each movement of Teresa and her cavalier. When their hands touched, he felt as though he should swoon. Every pulse beat with violence, and it seemed as though a bell were ringing in his ears. When they spoke, although Teresa listened timidly and with downcast eyes to the conversation of her cavalier, as Luigi could read in the ardent looks of the good-looking young man that his language was that of praise, it seemed as if the whole world was turning round him, and all the voices of hell were whispering in his ears ideas of murder and assassination. Then, fearing that his paroxysm might get the better of him, he clutched with one hand the branch of a tree against which he was leaning, and with the other convulsively grasped the dagger with a carved handle which was in his belt, and which unwittingly he drew from the scabbard from time to time. Luigi was jealous. He felt that, influenced by her ambition and coquettish disposition, Teresa might escape him. The young peasant girl, at first timid and scared, soon recovered herself. We have said that Teresa was handsome, but this is not all. Teresa was replete with all those wild graces which are so much more potent than our affected and studied elegances. She had almost all the honours of the quadrille, and if she were envious of the Comte de Saint-Felice's daughter, we will not undertake to say that Carmela was not jealous of her. And with overpowering compliments, her handsome cavalier led her back to the place whence he had taken her, and where Luigi awaited her. Twice or thrice during the dance, the young girl had glanced at Luigi, and each time she saw he was pale and his features agitated. Once even the blade of his knife, half drawn from its sheath, had dazzled her eyes with its sinister glare. Thus it was almost trembling that she resumed her lover's arm. The quadrille had been most perfect, and it was evident there was a great demand for a second edition. Carmela alone objecting to it, but the Comte de Saint-Felice begged his daughter so earnestly that she acceded to it. One of the cavaliers then hastened to invite Teresa, without whom it was impossible the quadrille could be formed, but the young girl had disappeared. The truth was that Luigi had not felt the strength to support another such trial, and half by persuasion and half by force he had removed Teresa towards another part of the garden. Teresa had yielded in spite of herself, but when she looked at the agitated countenance of the young man, she understood by his silence and trembling voice that something strange was passing within him. She herself was not exempt from internal emotion, and without having done anything wrong, yet fully comprehended that Luigi was right in reproaching her. Why, she did not know, but yet she did not the less feel that these reproaches were merited. However, to Teresa's great astonishment, Luigi remained mute, and not a word escaped his lips the rest of the evening. When the chill of the night had driven away the guests from the gardens, and the gates of the villa were closed on them for the fete indoors, he took Teresa quite away, and as he left her at her home, he said, "Teresa, what were you thinking of as you danced opposite the young Comtesse de Saint-Felice?" "I thought," replied the young girl, with all the frankness of her nature, "that I would give half my life for a costume such as she wore." "And what said your cavalier to you?" "He said it only depended on myself to have it, and I had only one word to say." "He was right," said Luigi. "Do you desire it as ardently as you say?" "Yes." "Well then, you shall have it." The young girl, much astonished, raised her head to look at him, but his face was so gloomy and terrible that her words froze to her lips. As Luigi spoke thus, he left her. Teresa followed him with her eyes into the darkness as long as she could, and when he had quite disappeared, she entered her apartment with a sigh. That night a great accident happened, no doubt from the imprudence of some servant who had neglected to extinguish the lights. The Villa de Saint-Felice took fire in the rooms adjoining the very apartment of the lovely Carmela. Awoke in the night by the light of the flames, she had sprung out of bed, wrapped herself in a dressing-gown, and attempted to escape by the door. But the corridor by which she hoped to fly was already a prey to the flames. She had then returned to her room, calling for help as loudly as she could, when suddenly her window, which was 20 feet from the ground, was opened. A young peasant jumped into the chamber and seized her in his arms, and with superhuman skill and strength conveyed her to the turf of the grass plot, where she fainted. When she recovered, her father was by her side. All the servants surrounded her, offering her assistance. An entire wing of the villa was burnt down, but what was that, as Carmela was safe and uninjured? Her preserver was everywhere sought for, but her deliverer did not appear. He was inquired for everywhere, but no one had seen him. Carmela was greatly troubled that she had not recognized him. As the Count was immensely rich, accepting the danger Carmela had run, and as appeared to him the marvellous manner in which she had escaped, which was rather a favour of Providence than a real misfortune, the loss occasioned by the conflagration was to him but a trifle. The next day, at the usual hour, the two young peasants were on the borders of the forest. Luigi arrived first. He came towards Teresa in high spirits, and seemed to have completely forgotten the events of the previous evening. The young girl was very pensive, but seeing Luigi so cheerful, she, on her part, assumed a smiling air, which was natural to her when no excitement of passion came to disturb her. Luigi took her arm beneath his own, and led her to the door of the grotto. Then he paused. The young girl, perceiving that there was something extraordinary, looked at him steadfastly. "Teresa," said Luigi, "yesterday evening you told me you would give all the world to have a costume similar to that of the Count's daughter." "Yes," replied Teresa with astonishment, "but I was mad to utter such a wish." And I replied, "Very well, you shall have it." "Yes," replied the young girl, whose astonishment increased at every word uttered by Luigi. "But of course your reply was only to please me." "I have promised no more than I have given you, Teresa," said Luigi proudly. "Go into the grotto and dress yourself." At these words he drew away the stone and showed Teresa the grotto, lighted up by 2 wax lights which burned on each side of a splendid mirror. On a rustic table made by Luigi were spread out the pearl necklace and the diamond pins, and on a chair at the side was laid the rest of the costume. Teresa uttered a cry of joy, and without inquiring whence this attire came, or even thanking Luigi, darted into the grotto transformed into a dressing-room. Luigi pushed the stone behind her, for he saw on the crest of a small adjacent hill, which prevented him from seeing Palestrina from where he was, a traveller on horseback, who stopped a moment, as if uncertain of his road, and thus presented in the blue sky that perfect outline peculiar to the distances of southern climes. When he saw Luigi, he put his horse into a gallop and advanced towards him. Luigi was not mistaken. The traveller, who was going from Palestrina to Tivoli, had mistaken his way. The young man directed him, but as at a quarter of a mile distance the road again divided into three ways, and on reaching these the traveller might again stray from his route, he begged Luigi to be his guide. Luigi threw his cloak on the ground, placed his carbine on his shoulder, and freed from his heavy covering, preceded the traveller with the rapid steps of a mountaineer, which a horse can scarcely keep up with. In 10 minutes Luigi and the traveller reached the crossroads alluded to by the young shepherd. On arriving there, with an air as majestic as that of an emperor, he stretched his hand towards that one of the roads which the traveller was to follow. "That is your road, Excellency, and now you cannot again mistake." "And here is your recompense," said the traveller, offering the young herdsman some pieces of small money. "Thank you," said Luigi, drawing back his hand. "I render a service. I do not sell it." "Well," replied the traveller, who seemed used to this difference between the civility of a man of the cities and the pride of the mountaineer. "If you refuse pay, you will perhaps accept of a present." "Ah, yes, that is another thing." "Then," said the traveller, "take these 2 Venice sequins and give them to your bride to make herself a pair of earrings." "And then do you take this poniard," said the young herdsman. "You will not find one better carved between Albana and Civita Castellana." "I accept it," answered the traveller, "but then the obligation will be on my side, for this poniard is worth more than 2 sequins. For a dealer, perhaps, but for me, who engraved it myself, it is hardly worth a piastre." "What is your name?" inquired the traveller. "Luigi Vampa," replied the shepherd, with the same air as he would have replied, "Alexander, King of Macedon." "And yours?" "I," said the traveller, "am called Sinbad the Sailor." Franz d'Epina started with surprise.
"Sinbad the Sailor?" he said.
"Yes," replied the narrator. "That was the name which the traveller gave to Vampa as his own."
"Well, and what have you to say against this name?" inquired Albert. "It is a very pretty name, and the adventures of the gentleman of that name amused me very much in my youth, I must confess."
Franz said no more. The name of Sinbad the Sailor, as may be well supposed, awakened in him a world of recollections, as had the name of the Count of Monte Cristo on the previous evening.
"Proceed," said he to the host.
Vampa put the 2 sequins haughtily into his pocket and slowly returned by the way he had gone. As he came within 200 or 300 paces of the grotto, he thought he heard a cry. He listened to know whence this sound could proceed. A moment afterwards, and he heard his own name pronounced distinctly. The cry proceeded from the grotto. He bounded like a chamois, cocking his carbine as he went, and in a moment reached the summit of a hill opposite to that on which he had perceived the traveller. Thence cries of help came more distinctly on his ear. He cast his eyes around him and saw a man carrying off Teresa, as did the centaur Nessus, de Janeiro. This man, who was hastening towards the wood, was already 3/4 of the way on the road from the grotto to the forest. Vampa measured the distance. The man was at least 200 paces in advance of him, and there was not a chance of overtaking him. The young shepherd stopped, as if his feet had been rooted to the ground. Then he put the butt of his carbine to his shoulder, took aim at the ravisher, followed him for a second on his track, and then fired. The ravisher stopped suddenly, his knees bent under him, and he fell with Teresa in his arms. The young girl rose instantly, but the man lay on the earth, struggling in the agonies of death. Vampa then rushed towards Teresa, for at 10 paces from the dying man her legs had failed her, and she had dropped on her knees, so that the young man feared the ball that had brought down his enemy had also wounded his betrothed. Fortunately she was unscathed, and it was fright alone that had overcome Teresa. When Luigi had assured himself that she was safe and unharmed, he turned towards the wounded man. He had just expired with clenched hands, his mouth in a spasm of agony, and his hair on end in the sweat of death. His eyes remained open and menacing. Vampa approached the carcass and recognised Cucumetto. From the day on which the bandit had been saved by the 2 young peasants, he had been enamoured of Teresa, and had sworn she should be his. From that time he had watched them,
and profiting by the moment when her lover had left her alone, whilst he guided the traveller on his way, had carried her off, and believed he at length had her in his power when the ball, directed by the unerring skill of the young herdsman, had pierced his heart. Vampa gazed on him for a moment without betraying the slightest emotion, whilst, on the contrary, Teresa, shuddering in every limb, dared not approach the slain ruffian but by degrees, and threw a hesitating glance at the dead body over the shoulder of her lover. Suddenly Vampa turned towards his mistress. "Ah, ah," said he, "good, good, you are attired. It is now my turn to dress myself." Teresa was clothed from head to foot in the garb of the Comte de Saint Felice's daughter. Vampa took Cucumetto's body in his arms and conveyed it to the grotto, whilst in her turn Teresa remained outside. If a second traveller had passed, he would have seen a strange thing, a shepherdess watching her flock, clad in a cashmere gown, with earrings and necklace of pearls, diamond pins, and buttons of sapphires, emeralds, and rubies. He would no doubt have believed that he had returned to the times of Florian, and would have declared on reaching Paris that he had met a shepherdess of the Alps seated at the foot of the Sabine Hill. At the end of a quarter of an hour, Vampa quitted the grotto. His costume was no less elegant than that of Teresa. He wore a vest of garnet-coloured velvet with buttons of cut gold, a silk waistcoat covered with embroidery, a Roman scarf tied round his neck, a cartouche box worked with gold and red and green silk, sky-blue velvet breeches fastened above the knee with diamond buckles, garters of deerskin worked with a thousand arabesques, and a hat whereon hung ribbons of all colours. Two watches hung from his girdle, and a splendid poniard was in his belt. Teresa uttered a cry of admiration. Vampa, in this attire, resembled a painting by Leopold Robert, or Schnetz. He had assumed the entire costume of Cucumetto. The young man saw the effect produced on his betrothed, and a smile of pride passed over his lips. "Now," he said to Teresa, "are you ready to share my fortune, whatever it may be?" "Oh, yes," exclaimed the young girl enthusiastically, "and follow me wherever I go, to the world's end. Then take my arm and let us on. We have no time to lose." The young girl did so without questioning her lover as to where he was conducting her, for he appeared to her at this moment as handsome, proud, and powerful as a god. They went towards the forest and soon entered it. We need scarcely say that all the paths of the mountain were known to Vampa. He therefore went forward without a moment's hesitation, although there was no beaten track. But he knew his path by looking at the trees and bushes, and thus they kept on advancing for nearly an hour and a half. At the end of this time they'd reached the thickest of the forest. A torrent, whose bed was dry, led into a deep gorge. Vampa took this wild road, which enclosed between two ridges, and shadowed by the tufted umbrage of the pines, seemed, but for the difficulties of its descent, that path to Avernus of which Virgil speaks. Teresa had become alarmed at the wild and deserted look at the plain around her, and pressed closely against her guide, not uttering a syllable. But as she saw him advance with even step and composed countenance, she endeavoured to repress her emotion. Suddenly, about 10 paces from them, a man advanced from behind a tree and aimed at Vampa. "Not another step," he said, "or you are a dead man." "What then?" said Vampa, raising his hand with a gesture of disdain, whilst Teresa, no longer able to restrain her alarm, clung closely to him. "Do wolves rend each other?" "Who are you?" inquired the sentinel. "I am Luigi Vampa, shepherd of the farm of San Felice." "What do you want?" "I would speak with your companions who are in the recess at Rocca Bianca." "Follow me then," said the sentinel, "or as you know your way, go first." Vampa smiled disdainfully at this precaution of the bandit, went before Teresa, and continued to advance with the same firm and easy step as before. At the end of 10 minutes the bandit made them a sign to stop. The two young persons obeyed. Then the bandit thrice imitated the cry of a crow. A croak answered this signal. "Good," said the sentry, "you may now advance." Luigi and Teresa again set forward. As they advanced, Teresa clung tremblingly to her lover, as she saw through the trees arms appear and the barrels of carbines shine. The retreat of Rocca Bianca was at the top of a small mountain, which no doubt in former days had been a volcano, an extinct volcano before the days when Remus and Romulus had deserted Alba to come and found the city of Rome. Teresa and Luigi reached the summit, and all at once found themselves in the presence of 20 bandits. "Here is a young man who seeks and wishes to speak to you," said the sentinel. "What has he to say?" inquired the man who was in command in the chief's absence. "I wish to say that I am tired of a shepherd's life," was Vampa's reply. "Ah,"
"I understand," said the lieutenant. "And you seek admittance into our ranks?" "Welcome," cried several bandits of Ferrucino, Pampanara, and Anagni, who had recognized Luigi Vampa. "Yes, but I come to ask something more than to be your companion." "And what may that be?" inquired the bandits with astonishment. "I come to ask to be your captain," said the young man. The bandits shouted with laughter. "And what have you done to aspire to this honour?" demanded the lieutenant. "I have killed your chief, Cucumetto, whose dress I now wear, and I set fire to the Villa San Felice to procure a wedding dress for my betrothed." An hour afterwards Luigi Vampa was chosen captain, Vice Cucumetto deceased.
"Well, my dear Albert," said Franz, turning towards his friend, "what think you of citizen Luigi Vampa?"
"I say he is a myth," replied Albert, "and never had an existence."
"And what may a myth be?" inquired Pastrini.
"The explanation would be too long, my dear landlord," replied Franz.
"And you say that Maitre Vampa exercises his profession at this moment in the environs of Rome?"
"And with a boldness of which no bandit before him ever gave an example."
"Then the police have vainly tried to lay hands on him."
"Why, you see, he has a good understanding with the shepherds in the plains, the fishermen of the Tiber, and the smugglers of the coast. They seek for him in the mountains, and he is on the waters. They follow him on the waters, and he is on the open sea. Then they pursue him, and he has suddenly taken refuge in the Isle of Giglio, of Guanuti, or Monte Cristo. And when they hunt for him there, he reappears suddenly at Albano, Tivoli, or La Riccia."
"And how does he behave towards travellers?"
"Alas, his plan is very simple. It depends on the distance he may be from the city, whether he gives 8 hours, 12 hours, or a day wherein to pay their ransom. And when that time has elapsed, he allows another hour's grace. At the 60th minute of this hour, if the money is not forthcoming, he blows out the prisoner's brains with a pistol shot, or plants his dagger in his heart, and that settles the account."
"Well, Albert," inquired Franz of his companion, "are you still disposed to go to the Colosseum by the outer boulevards?"
"Perfectly," said Albert, "if the way be picturesque." The clock struck 9 as the door opened, and a coachman appeared.
"Excellencies," said he, "the coach is ready."
"Well then," said Franz, "let us to the Colosseum."
"By the Porto del Popolo, or by the streets, your excellencies?"
"By the streets, morbleu, by the streets," cried Franz.
"Ah, my dear fellow," said Albert, rising and lighting his third cigar, "really, I thought you had more courage."
So saying, the two young men went down the staircase and got into the carriage.